ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, supporters of an Australian neo-Nazi group threatened two female politicians with rape and death after they condemn a weekend rally. Also, the US Senate passes a bill that could lead to the end of the country's long government shutdown. And AFL fans not happy about the introduction of a new wildcard round.
My first thought was, well, that's just a grab for money for an extra round.
I don't like it at all. I'd prefer to keep it as it is.
Just when I heard that they're extending it to 10, I thought, oh no, yeah.
In New South Wales, two female politicians have been threatened with death and rape after they condemned a neo-Nazi rally outside state parliament on the weekend. About 60 men dressed in black stood next to a sign that read, "Abolish the Jewish Lobby." Both the New South Wales Premier and the state's police force are under pressure to explain how the rally was allowed to go ahead in the first place. Julia Bergen reports.
First, there was a neo-Nazi rally. And then came the online abuse. After independent federal MP Allegra Spender spoke out on social media platform X to condemn the rally, she was subjected to a vile stream of messages threatening her with death and sexual violence.
It was pretty shocking and not something you ever want to hear, but we've referred it to the police.
It was the same for New South Wales State Liberal MP Kelly Sloan.
Dozens and dozens of pretty hateful messages. You know, some concerning enough to forward to police as a matter of process.
Kelly Sloan says the pile-on was revolting.
I sat on the couch last night and I was scrolling through all these messages and feeling pretty sick about it and then thought, what on earth am I doing? Why am I reading this garbage? But look, it's not about me. I'm, you know, on the weekend it was a protest against the Jewish community. Before, it's been about the Muslim community. They spew hatred at our Indian community. In fact, anyone who is not white, they take offence to.
At the neo-Nazi rally on Saturday morning, a large group of the men dressed in black were allowed to stand in front of New South Wales Parliament, flash an anti-Semitic banner and chant offensive tunes about Jews for around 20 minutes. They're the Sydney branch of the National Socialist Network, now called White Australia. New South Wales Police Commissioner Mal Lanyon says his officers knew the group planned to target Jews and knew what was going to be written on the banner. But because there was no legal issue and the neo-Nazi group had not posed any problems for police in the past, they signed off on the protest.
It's not a matter of allowing it to go ahead. It's a matter of whether or not we oppose it. And the reason that we would oppose it would be on public safety grounds or that there was going to be a significant disruption. The actual communication issue was the fact that I hadn't been personally briefed, so I'd not had the opportunity to brief either the minister or government.
But experts say otherwise, and that's because this is not the first time the group has protested in front of New South Wales State Parliament.
They had an authorised protest in June. Everything went well, they did everything according to plan, there was no hassle, there was no violence, and there was little media reporting of it. So from the police perspective, this is an event that's going to take 10 minutes to happen. It's not going to cause any violence or ongoing public order threats.
That's Dr. Kaz Ross, an independent researcher on far-right ideologies.
These rallies that they're holding, they're not intended to be demonstrations. They don't march. They don't engage with the public in any way. These are events which go for perhaps 10 minutes. The idea is to assemble a big crew of people, to have a banner, to do a few speeches, to get the video and the content, and then to disperse very quickly.
Dr. Kaz Ross says because the group is attempting to launch itself as an official political party and needs 750 members to do so, it's trying to keep its content clean and within the law. But she says the attacks on politicians, Allegra Spender and Kelly Sloan, set the group back.
It's been said before by the ASIO chief, Mike Burgess, that they walk right up to the line of legality. And as we've seen in a number of cases, well, the charges in Victoria, they cross that line of legality. But I believe that New South Wales is working hard to stay within that line. It does not help their cause to get registered as a political party, sending rape and death threats to a number of high-profile women online.
For public figures subjected to online hate, threats and abuse, the impact is lasting, and many say they have few protections. Deputy Greens leader Maureen Ferrucci.
When we get these horrific death threats or rape threats or threats about shooting your family on social media, we report every single one of them to the AFP. Some are investigated, some aren't.
Senator Maureen Ferrucci says it's even worse for female politicians and worse again for women of colour.
It is this intersection of sexism and racism that really impacts you. Sometimes you might temper what you want to say just because you know the backlash that's coming to you. That shouldn't be the case. Every single one of us should be allowed to speak the truth.
Dr. Kaz Ross is an independent researcher on far-right ideologies. That report from Julia Bergen. In the United States, it appears the nation's longest-running federal government shutdown is nearing an end after a group of Democratic Party senators decided to vote with Republicans in favour of legislation to reopen the government. The shutdown has been running for 40 days, seeing millions of federal employees working without pay, the closure of food programs for the needy, and a reduction in the number of domestic plane flights. David Smith is an associate professor at the United States Studies Centre at Sydney Uni, and I asked him to explain what happened in this Senate vote late on Sunday night, Washington time.
So just enough Democrats have crossed the floor in order to get the 60 votes to break the filibuster. So there are 8 Democrats who felt that the damage that was being done by the shutdown was just too great. We've seen massive air traffic disruption across the US over the last few days because there are air traffic controllers who are working without pay. And now millions of Americans are standing to lose the benefits of food stamps. So, you know, potentially facing food insecurity. So they just felt that the costs were getting too much, especially to their own constituents. So they voted to end the shutdown.
Is this just the first step to ending the shutdown, though?
It is just the first step. So this now has to go back to the House of Representatives. That's at least going to take a couple of days before it finally goes to the president's desk to be signed. The deal that is being done also is mostly temporary. Most of it only funds the government until January 30th. Then we could be facing the whole process again. Democrats in the end gave up on their demand to extend Obamacare subsidies, which without those, a lot of Americans are going to face very sharp increases in health insurance premiums. Republicans have agreed as part of their end of the bargain to allow a vote on that in December, but there's no assurance that that vote is going to pass. So a lot of Americans could still be left in a very precarious situation by this.
Is there a chance that some Democrats will still object to this legislation and delay the process even further?
Some of them will want to delay it. Some of them are very angry by the fact that it is ending in this way, essentially without them getting any real concessions. But there's not much more that they can do now because Republicans have the majority in the House of Representatives. In the House of Representatives, there's no filibuster. They only need a majority. And even though there are some Republicans who are also unhappy about it, it should be able to pass on Republican votes alone.
And Dr. Smith, just remind us what a filibuster is in the American political process.
So the filibuster is a protocol in the Senate which says that the minority party can stop an issue coming to a vote altogether. They can basically just delay debate indefinitely as long as they have 40 votes. So there are 100 votes in the Senate. So this effectively requires 3/5 of senators rather than an absolute majority. This is not something that's in the Constitution. This is a protocol that is there that both parties tend to follow because they always know that one day they're going to be in the minority. And when they're in the minority, they see this as very important as a check on the majority. Donald Trump has really been voicing a lot of anger with the filibuster in the last few days. urging Republicans to get rid of it altogether in order to just force Republican priorities through. But Republican senators said that there was no way that that was going to happen, and that's because they know that if they get rid of the filibuster, the next time they're a minority, then they will also be vulnerable.
So the shutdown, it seems, isn't quite over yet. What do you think this shutdown, this impasse, has done to both sides of politics in the US?
In terms of public opinion, it's actually hurt Republicans more. So polls suggest that the majority of Americans blame Republicans for the shutdown, and it has certainly done nothing to help Donald Trump's approval. Donald Trump's approval ratings, after months of being pretty stable, not that great, but stable, they are now really plummeting. And this is one of the reasons why Trump himself was getting so angry about the situation. The election results that we saw last week, which were big wins for Democrats across the board, whether they were left-wing Democrats or centrist Democrats, they reflect a lot of that frustration with the Republican Party at the moment. And even people who voted for Trump are feeling very frustrated with Republicans. One of the things that Trump promised was that after 3 years of a cost of living crisis, that he would bring prices down. He has not brought most prices down, and some of his policies, like tariffs, are actively putting prices up. So people are not happy about this at all. They're not happy about Republican management of the economy or about Republican priorities or about Donald Trump's priorities in all of this. So the shutdown, I would say, politically has really hurt Republicans more than Democrats. But at the same time, with the shutdown ending this way, a lot of Democrats are going to be angry that Democrats didn't take the fight further. And this has been one of the big criticisms of Democrats this year from their own supporters, that they're spineless, that they haven't really done anything to stop Donald Trump. And the shutdown ending this way is not going to help Democrats either.
Dr. David Smith from the United States Studies Centre at Sydney Uni. In Tasmania, the salmon industry has been given emergency approval by a federal authority to use a new antibiotic to treat bacterial disease. The move comes after salmon farms in the state's southeast suffered unprecedented fish kills last summer. 15,000 tonnes of salmon were lost and rotting fish were found on local beaches. But the decision to use the antibiotic is worrying recreational fishers and experts concerned about the use of antibiotics in food production. Alexandra Humphreys has more.
When Tasmanians headed to the state's southeastern beaches earlier this year, some of them were greeted by rotting chunks of farmed salmon. An outbreak of disease meant salmon companies were dealing with the deaths of the fish on a massive scale. Aiming to prevent a similar outbreak, the industry applied for access to a new antibiotic to treat its stock. The emergency federal approval has now been granted.
What we're proposing to do is to use fluorphenicol, which is the most effective treatment for salmon. It's safe for humans and it's the best choice for the environment.
John Whittington is the chief executive of industry body Salmon Tasmania.
What we don't want is what happened last summer. We don't want that to happen again.
It's the first time fluorphenicol has been used in aquaculture in Australia. Salmon producer Tassal is already using it at two sites. Tasmania's public health director Mark Veitch is warning recreational fishers there could be some contamination of wild fish around the salmon farms.
For 21 days and for 3Ks around these treated leases, you should consider not eating those fish if you don't want to have some possibility of encountering fluorphenicol in your fish.
That sparked outrage among talkback callers to local radio.
We cannot have this amount of antibiotics being poured into our rivers and channels.
It's just unthinkable. It doesn't make sense.
I think it's safe to say there's a lot of emotion out there at the moment.
Jane Galashan is Chief Executive of the Tasmanian Association for Recreational Fishing.
One in three Tasmanians in the southeast go fishing. I mean, it is the highest participation rate of anywhere else in Tasmania, and it's also where we have salmon farms. What I don't want to see is Tasmanian fishing families not being able to go fishing this year.
Ms. Galashan points out that it's difficult for recreational fishers to identify where and when when antibiotics are used on salmon farms.
There's a lot of questions around transparency, sort of which farms, which areas will be affected, those sorts of things, and how will people receive notification and information, especially if antibiotic use grows over the summer period, and we probably expect that it will.
John Whittington concedes the industry's communications with recreational fishers need improvement.
I think we can do a lot better as government, industry combined to ensure that we have really clear, transparent information about where treatments are occurring. Industry is absolutely committed to that. I'm sure government will be.
In general, any excessive use of antibiotics, whether it's human, agricultural, is of concern.
Professor Mark Blaskovich is from the Institute for Molecular Bioscience with the University of Queensland. He explains antimicrobial resistance is a global health concern. That's where bacteria become resistant to being killed by antibiotics.
Fluorfenicol is an antibiotic which is used just in agriculture, but it's closely related or part of the same class as other antibiotics, such as chloramphenicol, which are commonly used in humans. And there is what's called cross-resistance between those. So if a bacteria becomes resistant to fluorphenicol, it can also become resistant to that human antibiotic as well.
According to Professor Blaskovich, antibiotic resistance is getting worse.
If it becomes prevalent at a high level where the bacteria that infect us can't be killed anymore by the antibiotics that we commonly use, it means that the fundamental underpinnings of our modern medical system won't be viable anymore.
That's Professor Mark Blaskovich from the University of Queensland. Alexandra Humphreys reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Good to be back with you. Just a reminder, you can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Experts in women's health are urging governments around the country to act on the findings of a groundbreaking inquiry into women's pain. Commissioned by the Victorian government, the investigation found that women experiencing debilitating abdominal or arthritis pain are often dismissed or disrespected in the state's healthcare system. The inquiry has made a number of recommendations, including the development of a women's pain action plan and the setting up of special clinics to help girls and teenagers. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
27-year-old Victorian Ali Pimenta was just 11 years old when her endometriosis pain became unbearable.
It was like I had hot knives from like my hips up to my belly button that would go all across the front of my stomach, around into my back, just stabbing me.
Ms. Parmenta struggled to access care because she lived in regional Victoria, but also the health professionals she dealt with didn't believe her pain was severe.
I had months and months and months of time off work. There was a point where I couldn't work, could hardly get out of bed without being able to barely stand up because of the pain in my back and my legs. I'd vomit, I wouldn't be able to eat. And it was just all the time.
It's a similar story for tens of thousands of Victorian women surveyed for Australia's first ever inquiry into women's pain. It found 90% of people experienced pain that lasted over a year. Half said they were experiencing pain daily, and a third were in pain constantly. The most common conditions were period pain, endometriosis and arthritis. Women with disabilities and from the LGBTIQA+ community reported higher rates of prolonged pain. The report also found medical professionals often dismissed or disrespected women, underestimating their pain and providing them insufficient treatment. Dr. Nisha Cott is the president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
As doctors, we recognise that we have not done very well with women's pain because part of it is that we haven't had the research. So we haven't been able to manage that because we don't know what to do with it. The best way of managing pain, especially chronic pain, is in a multidisciplinary team where you have all of the relevant specialties who can help you manage the pain.
Monica Filano is the chair of Endometriosis Australia.
This is systemic medical misogyny. It's not the fault of clinicians. It's not the fault of GPs. It's the amount of training that's given on women's health and the amount of, or the lack of research there is in women's physiology.
She says the issue is widespread and is calling on the federal government to intervene. Professor Sonia Grover is the director of the Department of Gynecology at the Royal Children's Hospital. She says she's not surprised by the findings.
I see enough people who have had their pain ignored, or people just haven't had their pain validated. I have no doubt the issue that we have seen and uncovered in Victoria is replicated in the other parts of Australia.
The majority of her patients are under the age of 18 and says the pain of young girls is often ignored.
14-year-old who I'd seen who had horrendously heavy periods and pain and had gone to a GP, and the GP had said, get over it, you know, you're a woman, you'll get used to it, and she'd given her an antidepressant. Now, that young woman had a bleeding disorder.
Professor Grover says more nationwide research into the issue is vital. She says early intervention is key and is opening a new Victoria-wide program to help combat the problem in July 2026.
The intention is to establish a statewide program so that we can improve access for young people. That could be replicated Australia-wide, but clearly would need funding.
The federal government has invested $573 million into women's health, including funding for 33 endometriosis and pelvic pain clinics over 3 years in all states and territories. But Professor Grover fears it's not enough.
I am very anxious that those pelvic pain clinics are not being accessed by teenagers or the little kids who have pain. So the group of people we should be trying to intervene is the younger cohort.
Federal Assistant Minister for Women and Health Rebecca White says endometriosis and pelvic pain clinics are also accessible to children under the age of 18.
Kathleen O'Connor with that report. The Australian Football League's decision to shake up the men's final series is drawing a passionate response from fans. The biggest change in decades will see the 9th and 10th teams on the ladder join the top eight in the finals for a wild card round. The AFL is hoping the new setup will add more excitement to the season's end, but some supporters are accusing the league of greed. Kimberly Price filed this report.
You'd have no idea who's going to win this game from here on in.
For the past 25 years, the AFL's final series has been made up of the top eight teams at the end of the home and away season. Next year, that will change in what's seen as a radical shake-up. The 9th and 10th placed teams will be brought into the action for a wild card round at the start of the finals. It'll keep more teams in the hunt for grand final glory, but on the streets of Melbourne, the fans are not keen on the rule change.
My first thought was, well, that's just a grab for money for an extra round. My team's Carlton, so probably will, because we'll probably will end up 10th. But even if Carlton wins in the first round, I don't think it has much legitimacy.
No, I don't like it at all. I'd prefer to keep it as it is. The fact that I don't like it doesn't mean anything. I probably will still watch it, yes.
The final eight was, I thought, worked really well. Will it be 12 in a few more years' time? Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's just getting a bit beyond the pale, I think.
Under the new system, the top six teams will get a week off at the start of the finals. Teams 7, 8, 9 and 10 will use that first week to play in the new wildcard round for a chance to play again the next week. AFL Chief Executive Andrew Dillon says the change comes after years of consultation with clubs.
What we feel is by expanding the final series, we'll have more games of consequence during the home and away, which we know our fans love. We know fans will go to those games. We know they'll watch them in numbers.
A survey of 5,500 punters by the AFL Fans Association revealed 77% did not support a wildcard round. Ron Isco is the association's president.
What fans are simply saying is this: if you're going to have the 9th and 10th team that probably have lost more games than they've won, have a chance to win the premiership and give them the premiership cup for losing more than they've won, that dilutes the value of the premiership, it dilutes the value of the finals, and it dilutes the whole home and away season.
Jake Nile is the chief AFL writer for The Age newspaper and believes the two extra final games will bring in substantial income for the league.
The NRL have made a lot of ground commercially, particularly through having State of Origin, which is like having three extra grand finals. So the AFL is creating a big tent, agenda where they want to have more marquee, more big events, and having these two games creates that.
But Jake Nile believes the wildcard round won't favour the teams at the lower end of the final 10.
And it probably advantages the fifth team and sixth team, who get a week off in a bye with the other top six teams. I think it'll be very difficult to get into a grand final from 7th or 8th, let alone 9th or 10th.
Jake Nile says the announcement has come ahead of the 2026 fixture release, which is expected in the next week. Former AFLW coach and St Kilda player Nathan Burke slammed the AFL's decision to hold yesterday's press conference in the middle of an AFLW finals match.
To announce that whilst there was a final still playing, it was just after halftime of a final playing, that's just ignorance.
As for the new finals format, Nathan Burke believes the wild card round will help the competition stay relevant.
You'd probably expect me, as an old dinosaur fuddy-duddy traditionalist, to say this is a load of garbage, you can't get in the finals. But in some ways, we do have to keep advancing the game.
A wild card round has not been announced for next year's AFLW season.
Kimberly Price reporting. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 3 hours of free electricity in the middle of the day sounds pretty good. But is the federal government's latest solar offer going to reduce hefty power bills? Or is there a catch? Today, energy expert from the Grattan Institute, Alison Reeve, unpacks the ups and downs of the scheme. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.